think telling the community that she's a victim of sexual assault, having to get on the witness stand and withstand cross-examination from someone with your experience, was fun for her?
And I don't think the justice system is set up in any way, shape, or form to actually bring justice to a situation like that or determine the truth.
It is just a sad fact today in our society that more rape cases are lost in trial than are won.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and currently writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is my lovely co-host.
Hi, Jim. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. I'm glad to be with you from sunny Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Awesome. And today we have a very special guest, colleague Kirk Nurmi. He's the attorney who defended the infamous Jody Arias. How you doing, Kirk?
Good. Good to be with you both.
Well, thank you so much for coming on Best Case, Worst Case. As you know, this is a podcast where we try to take our listeners behind police lines, behind the cases, tell them the things that happen to the people, the professionals that work on the side of justice and investigations and court cases. And of course, you were involved in a really huge way in one of the biggest cases of our time, and that was the trial of Jody Arias. But today, we'd like to talk to you about what the best case of your career was. And to begin with, can you just tell us what kind of case it is? Not the specifics, but just what kind of case? Can we start there?
Sure. This was a case my client was charged with sex assault and kidnapping. It was a few counts of sexual assault and one count of kidnapping.
And how did the case come to you?
I was working as a public defender at the time. This was probably 5-6 years ago now, and I was working as a public defender. This is before I joined the Capital Unit of the Public Defender's Office.
Okay, and so tell us the circumstances. What went on? Like when you found the case? Like what did you know? Did it seem like it was going to be a difficult case? Did it seem like it was going to be a no-brainer? What were the circumstances?
Well, when we get a case at the public defender's office, we would generally get a police report, and that was all we get. And we'd get a chance to read it before we would talk to our client. And the basic facts were that my client was a young man who returned from Desert Storm and had PTSD. He didn't stay over there long, and he was kind of struggling when he got back. And he took a job as a waiter in a restaurant, and that is where he met the supposed victim, who was a hostess at this restaurant. They began a relationship. She was about 10 years his senior. They began a relationship. As the relationship developed, she explained to him of her interest and involvement in the S&M lifestyle. She began involving him in different activities related to that, learning how to properly choke, flog, which is an advanced form of spanking with instruments, things of that nature, and they began to incorporate this into their sexual activities.
So just for our listeners who aren't familiar with S&M, this is a practice of consensual sexual activity, right? That has a lot of rules and a lot of regulations and a lot of safety features, I mean, in general, but obviously people can sort of take it to one extreme or another, right?
In essence, that's correct. I mean, it was a new world for him. I mean, she really indoctrinated him, and this particular woman was very involved in it. So there were rules. She actually went to, you know, parties where there was training, and she was teaching him how to proper choking techniques, proper spanking techniques, and all different sorts of restraints. And she was teaching him a lot about this lifestyle, which was completely new to him.
So I have a question, Kirk. First, for our listeners, sure. I should say that it's fairly unusual for us to have a defense attorney on. I think it's important to get perspective from everyone involved in the criminal justice system. Everyone has a right to counsel under our Constitution. I'm very glad about that. It's a critically important protection that I think sets our country apart from many countries. But when you say that she was into the lifestyle and it was all about S&M and she was teaching him all of this, where did you get all of this information? I mean, what I'm wondering is this sort of thing that came out at trial? Is this what she admitted to? Or is this just something that your client told you in preparation for handling whatever the charges were?
Well, that's a great question. And Francie, I think if I go a little more into the background of the case, I'll wind up answering your question.
Great.
The incident and issue, the sexual assault at issue, took place. They were together in her apartment, her home, and she went after this sexual encounter. He left. She went to a convenience store, bought a pack of cigarettes, and then called her master. Just to further educate the listener, she had someone in the S&M community who was her controller, in essence, and told her whom she could have sex with, when, et cetera, et cetera. And after her conversation with her master, he told her that a rape had occurred. And she then called the police department. And this gets to your question, Francie. When the officer responded to her home, she explained all of this to the officer, all about her background and et cetera, et cetera. And so this was known, this was in the police report before I even read any of, or even had talked to my client or really immersed myself in the case.
Kirk, that was not a point of dispute then. The S&M lifestyle was legitimately not in dispute between them. She admitted that she really was a part of that.
Yes, right away. She told the officer and explained her involvement in pretty solid detail.
All right. And so, Kirk, you mentioned the term her master, and you said that he tells her who she can have sex with. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I'm not really well-versed in this, and I'm sure some of our listeners aren't either. So can you explain what that means, that relationship there, the master?
Well, for whatever reason, folks in the S&M community, particularly the female part of the equation, get a sexual thrill, I guess, out of having a master who kind of controls their sex life. And she literally was supposed to call this person and get his permission to have sex with anyone else. And beyond that, I don't know that I can explain the psychology that would make someone want to do that, Jim, but that was the dynamics of her relationship with her master.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but the issue of her calling and being required to get permission before she has sex, does that become a critical issue in this case?
No, it really didn't. What really became a critical issue, and I should explain one more thing in terms of the background of the case. After this was reported to the police, they did what was called, what you're probably both familiar with, and maybe listeners to your show are familiar with. They did a confrontation call, and a confrontation call is a trumped up call where a alleged victim will call the person they believe violated them, and with the police taping and listening to it, and in an effort to garner a confession in a non-police fashion, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's used a lot in Arizona. I'm sure it's used a lot elsewhere. A call like this was made to my client. She and my client were on the phone for about 45 minutes. And at the end of this discussion, he said, and this might be an exact quote, I might be paraphrasing a bit, but fine, I raped you if that's what you want to hear. After he made that statement, he was then arrested by the police and interrogated by the police. And again, with that confession in their hand, the police were also able to obtain another confession. So the issue was, in the case, really was the nature and the validity of the confession.
And so when you say that he confessed when he was in police custody, did he do it in the same, as you've described, offhand manner that he did with her, or was it more detailed?
Well, it wasn't really any more detailed, because the interesting part of this case, I guess, Francie, would be that there wasn't much dispute about what happened in terms of that the sexual encounter did happen and some of the activities that took place, just that whether or not it was consensual, because she had openly admitted to the police that she had had rape fantasies, which she had shared with my client. So it was really an issue of consent.
And so what was your initial take on the case once you looked into it? Did you think to yourself, well, this is a case that I'm never going to take a plea on, we should go to trial? Or how did you make those decisions?
Well, obviously, when you get a police report, coming from a defense attorney's perspective, you don't just accept everything as verbatim fact. You have this case, and obviously it was a interesting one, and you begin to think, well, what is a jury going to think of all this? And you talk to your client and you get more details of the case. You interview witnesses, you interview the police, you talk to, in this case, I wound up retaining a false confession expert, talking to him about the viability of the confession, that sort of thing. So you end up trying to kind of analyze how the case will play out in front of a jury, and also inserting those facts that your client tells you along the way.
And Kirk, how do you determine whether or not your client is telling you the truth? I mean, forgive me for being cynical, but I am a former prosecutor here, and so is Jim. And I'm very well aware that many clients, I might characterize it as most defendants, lie to their attorneys. So how do you go about deciding whether or not you think your client's telling you the truth?
Well, I think from a defense attorney's perspective, ultimately, especially using this case as a prime example, you don't really know. You don't really know what happened in the context of that room, whether or not a sexual assault occurred, or this was really her acting out her rape fantasy with her then boyfriend. You don't really know. And ultimately, I would say, Francie, I think you might have to confess that, even though prosecutors tend to believe they know, a prosecutor really wouldn't know what happened in this room at this point in time. They just don't know.
Right. I think both sides are hampered in that way. And obviously, one of the jobs of a prosecutor is to assess the credibility of the evidence brought before them, and whether that's witness testimony, eyewitness testimony, complainant testimony, victim testimony, forensic evidence, all that stuff, police testimony. There's a whole bunch of different factors, and I think everybody has a responsibility in this justice system to actually make sure that they're not relying on something that it is not credible.
Yes, and And I think if there hadn't been a confession, I don't really know whether the prosecutor would have gone forward or not. It was really a bizarre or unique set of circumstances, to say the least.
Well, it sounds like it definitely was. So my question then is, did this case end up going to trial? With there obviously being the disputed issue is whether or not there was consent. It's not whether or not they engaged in a sexual relationship, but whether or not that sex was forth, whether it met the definition of rape or not. So did you take the case to trial?
We did. We wound up taking the case to trial, and which is the nerve-wracking proposition for the defense attorney, because when you think there is a good chance your client might be innocent, those are the toughest trials to face. But we did take the case to trial. We had a false confession expert talk about those in the military, their adherence to authority, the fact that the cops were able to obtain a more formal confession because of his prior offhand comment. And I felt like we had, and the client chooses whether or not we go to trial or not. And the defense attorney just gives advice. And I thought, of course, that we had a viable case. The problem was, under Arizona law, best as I can recall, he was looking at least 15 years of imprisonment had he lost this case.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Right. Can I just ask you something? You said that they obtained a more formal confession. Do you happen to know what kind of detail was in that confession? What, you know, rather than just saying, okay, if that's what you want to hear, I raped you, was there more details? I mean, was it the specific acts that were done? Was it, as you say, the spanking and the choking involved? What was it that was in that more formal confession?
It was more related to the acts that were involved, and the police were zeroing in on her consent, and he was talking about these different things. And I thought it was weak in the sense that the detective was really zeroing in on trying to say, she didn't consent, she didn't consent, she didn't consent. And he went round and round in these rape fantasies, and he says, well, you used the word rape when you admitted it to her. I can play back the tape. Well, yeah, I guess so. I guess that's what I did, kind of thing. So it wasn't like detailed in the sense that, well, I knew she didn't want it, but I kept going, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, is it true, though, that they had had encounters like that were virtually the same as this before, and it was just now she's saying that this one in particular she didn't consent to? I'm just missing what the actual allegation was then.
Well, sure. Her accusation was that this is one that she didn't consent to, that this was a rape. And when she got on the stand to testify, she testified to the fact that it was non-consensual. He didn't use the proper choking techniques. She had other kinds of explanations as to why she thought this wasn't consensual. But there's some other interesting facts about her testimony, if you want me to go on, that I think will illuminate things. She testified, and this was one of the strangest cross-examinations I've ever had, because when I was watching her on the stand, I believed that she was enjoying herself.
What do you mean by that?
I came to the conclusion that this was part of her fantasy, that being this victim of rape was one of her was a sexual thrill for her.
So you think telling the community that she's a victim of sexual assault, having to get on the witness stand and withstand cross-examination from someone with your experience, was fun for her?
I do believe it was a sexual thrill. I believe that this girl was, obviously we've talked about her background, the S&M, some of that stuff. I do believe it was enjoyable for her. Yes.
Yeah. Francie, he's not saying that it's because she was actually raped. What he's saying is that from his perspective, it looked like this was all part of a fantasy that she conceived of this, you know, in her fantasy life, and this was her living it out. And part of that, living that fantasy out, was being raped and then testifying about it in front of court. I mean, there are people that do have certain mental disorders that, or it could be a fetish instead of a mental disorder, I suppose, but that might be exciting too. That's what you're saying, that you believed she was doing.
Yes.
Well, I understood that, Jim. I understand that part perfectly well. It's what I'm having trouble with because, again, not to be argumentative about it, Kirk, because I certainly appreciate you coming on and giving your perspective, but what qualifies you to make that kind of determination that this woman who maybe was into S&M was somehow also gaming the system and working through some kind of sick fantasy? This is a shocking allegation, in my opinion.
Because I have dealt with, Francie, because I have dealt with people and dealt with numerous sex cases where victims, real victims of sexual assault, don't act like this woman did.
Tell us how she acted.
Yeah. It's all how she acted. And the other thing, Francie, I should tell you, as the direct examination went on, she admitted that this supposed sexual encounter, she was along the way dictating the terms of what took place. She told him that she didn't want to perform oral sex. Oral sex didn't take place. She told him that she didn't want anal sex to take place. And anal sex didn't take place. So there was a lot of things in her main basis for her argument that this was improper was that he did not use the proper choking technique. And that is what she relied on over and over again. And I do believe that this was part of her fetish, part of her interest. And Francie, I will say that as argumentative as you want to be to that point, as appalling as it might sound, the jury ended up agreeing with me.
Well, Listen. Juries are, in my opinion, are predisposed to disbelieve rape victims. It is just a sad fact today in our society that more rape cases are lost in trial than are won. And I think that's because of a bias in society, because of so many times when the woman is the one who's put on trial. I mean, you remember in the O.J. Simpson murder case, Nicole's behavior and Ron's behavior and whether or not they were on drugs, the victims were put on trial. So the victims are always put on trial in sexual assault cases. And so juries have expectations that women are going to behave a certain way, that children are going to behave a certain way. If you've seen the new TV show, The Jury Speaks, you saw potentially one juror who came out after the Michael Jackson case and said she didn't believe the male victim that Michael Jackson had molested him because he didn't cry on the witness stand. And it's those kinds of archaic attitudes that, in my opinion, are more responsible for the loss in rape cases than it is false allegations. But I'm sure we agree to disagree there.
I get both sides of what you're saying, Francie and Kirk. And we weren't there, but I would like to get the listeners behind the scenes and find out from you, Kirk, what it was that you saw, the actual behaviors. I mean, what was she doing? Was she smiling? Was it crocodile tears? What was it that gave you the indicator that she was actually enjoying this? And then is there more that happened on cross? Is there more that happened during the trial that actually gave fuel to the fire that this woman was not actually raped?
Sure. If you don't mind, before I take that question, could I respond to Francie for a quick second?
Oh, sure. Sorry.
Yeah, Francie, what I would say is that, you know, you're attacking my belief and my assertion that I observed. But what I would say is that you are infusing a bias in terms of you're presuming that this person is guilty. You don't know anything about the case, and you're presuming that there is a bias against rape victims when it might just very well be the case that this was a false accusation. Now,
Kirk, let me just say really quickly, I don't dispute that false accusations happen. I don't dispute that at all. I mean, as you and Jim have both said, I wasn't there and I don't know the facts of the case. But what I'm saying is I stand firmly behind the belief that there is a bias against rape victims in this country. But please, I'm interested in your answer to Jim's question about the behaviors that you observed.
Well, sure. I mean, there was just a general sense of her behavior. It didn't seem genuine, Jim. It was crocodile tears. It was very... Like, for example, you know, she's sexually assaulted. She goes to the 7-Eleven and buys a pack of cigarettes, and half hour, 45 minutes later, she calls the police. And, you know, just there was so much about what she said and the holes in her story and the dictating the terms and the emphasis she placed on the improper choking technique. And just, you know, I don't think I was the only one, like I say, in the courtroom that felt like something just wasn't right about what she was saying and how she was saying it and her whole dynamic with this master, because it was really her master who told her that this was a sexual assault related to her consent, not calling him first, et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot that was really fishy about this determination that this was a sexual assault.
Well, I think that's a fundamental issue. I would, as a prosecutor, I would have had a really difficult time getting over that hurdle where she is actually usurping control over her consent to have sex to another person who was not present. I mean, that's completely bizarre. And to me, it would undermine any kind of, I mean, by doing that and that outside person being the one to say after the fact that she didn't have authority to consent at that point, and therefore there was no consent, to me, that's a major hole in the prosecution's case.
Well, I find it very difficult to accept that is the impetus of the case itself. I find it very difficult that what happened was she told prosecutors, I called my master. He said I was raped, so I guess I was raped. And the case proceeded. I don't believe that at all. There had to be something more to it.
But wasn't that what you said that she said?
Kirk? Yes, that's exactly it. What the something more came in the form of the confession. That's where the something more came in. Like I said earlier in the show, I don't believe that the prosecutors would have proceeded without this offhand confession and then done during the confrontation call and then during his encounter with police.
So did you end up crossing her?
I did, and I emphasized the point of her dictation. We talked about her training him on choking techniques and what he supposedly did wrong and how she dictated the terms of this encounter and how he complied with the dictates that she laid forward.
Okay, and did your client end up taking the stand?
No.
Okay, and did you put forth a case or just cross-examine their witnesses?
We put forth a case. We had a false confessions expert who had looked at the confession and looked at my client's background. I think probably I forgot to mention that the client, when he came back from the war, was diagnosed with PTSD. This expert, the psychologist, spent some time with my client, reviewed his records, talked to the jury about military authority and the adherence to authority and the different issues that could relate to the PTSD and his involvement in this relationship. And that was the entirety of the defense case.
I just don't believe for a second that PTSD is somehow related to someone falsely confessing to a sexual assault of his girlfriend. That does not compute with me at all. And while I appreciate, Kirk, that you convinced a jury of it and your expert convinced a jury of it, he didn't even take the stand in his defense, which is, of course, his absolute right not to testify, but which speaks volumes to me about your presumed advice to him probably not to take the stand because you were worried about him being cross-examined about that particular confession or cross-examined about who knows what else might have been in his background that you knew about. But I just do not buy this claim that PTSD of a war veteran is somehow related to confessing to a crime you didn't commit.
Well, you should perhaps take a look at some of the research on false confessions and PTSD. Obviously, people with PTSD have a lack or a desire for a lack of contention. There is trauma involved. It is a serious condition. And, you know, Francie, you can believe what you want, but at the same, and again, I repeat the fact that you seem to be advancing a belief that anybody who makes an accusation or anyone is accused of a sex crime is guilty and their Sixth Amendment rights go out the window, because what you have just attacked basically is my client's choice to exercise his Sixth Amendment rights. And to me, that is a serious problem that we're having in our society, and is this idea that people are presuming guilt and not affording somebody their Sixth Amendment rights. And it is not necessarily a matter of trickery when a defense attorney wins a case, Francie. It is could be a matter of justice.
Yeah.
I certainly don't dispute that justice operates sometimes in ways that I find a little bit mysterious. But here, just because you won doesn't mean she wasn't sexually assaulted.
No, but also the thing is, it's not just one thing. It's not just PTSD. It's not just how she testified. It's not just the circumstances, but it's the whole totality of the circumstances. The fact that they were engaged in a course of action during sex play that simulated rape creates a, in my mind, a very difficult situation. I would suggest that no woman ever and no man ever engage in this kind of activity because of this fact. Because if somebody does actually want to withdraw consent, it may appear to be that's they're playing and they actually want to get raped. It's a very dangerous situation. And I don't think it is really possible under those circumstances to gain a conviction if the rape actually happens, because of the clear discussion, training, and preoccupation with this fantasy wrapped around actual physical violence and sex. So, you know, it's a dangerous practice. And I don't think the justice system is set up in any way, shape, or form to actually bring justice to a situation like that or determine the truth in a situation like that. And I think that's why we have such contentious disagreement on this case. And I'm sure there was the same kind of thing in the courtroom.
Well, there was. I mean, I think the prosecutor knew, she's a very experienced prosecutor, and knew that her case had holes in it because of this background and because of this victim. I don't think true rape victims get to dictate the terms of the interaction. So, I knew that there were holes there. And you're right, Jim, to bring up the whole litany of things that were wrong with the case or that brought reasonable doubt into the case. And a jury that really, it can't be proven beyond a reasonable doubt what exactly occurred in this thing, to my belief, did the right thing by acquitting my client.
Well, I really appreciate, and Francie, I'm sure, also appreciates you coming and tell us about this case. Obviously, this is a case that brings up a lot of issues within the justice system, and it dredges up issues about how women are treated in rape cases. And I will add, men are treated the same way in rape cases when they are victims, and children of both genders are. There's a lot of issues with that. It's a very difficult thing. And it's a very difficult topic for the justice system to address. It only gets clouded more, in my mind, when adults engage in activity that is clearly dancing on the wire of consent and basically pushing the meaning of consent. And I just don't know that it's healthy to get, to mix violence and sex in the same encounter.
Well, I certainly agree with that, Jim. And Kirk, I definitely appreciate your coming in and talking to us about your best case. I understand why, from a defense attorney's perspective, it is your best case. So I really appreciate it.
All right.
And I enjoyed the discussion, Francie.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sure that our listeners have opinions about this, and we invite you to write to us on our Facebook page, and let's engage in a discussion about this. This is only the beginning. And till next time, signing off for Best Case, Worst Case. Thank you, Kirk. Thank you, Francie.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production, produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Terrell Parham. Music by Simba Sumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.